Greetings and may the peace of Christ be with you. Welcome to Holy Family Radio. This is Deacon Jim Thorndale and I'm privileged to be your host today. I warmly invite you to enter into another conversation in living the Catholic life. You know, as I live my Catholic life, sometimes I make decisions all day long about what I'm going to do, where I'm going to go to work that day, maybe decisions on who I'm going to talk to, or just every day we make decisions in our life, and we never think of the repercussions of what they may do for others or how we have to really make those decisions in the light of a good conscience. So when I'm thinking about that, I think, what is it that would force a man or woman who would be a judge to have to really understand that when the decisions they're making become so critical in the lives of other people? And in front of me today, I have just such a man who has to make those decisions on an everyday basis. I am here with I'm going to call him the Honorable Judge James Redford here in Grand Rapids. And Jim, it's great to have you here.
Deacon Jim, thank you. It's very nice to be with you as well.
Oh, you're so welcome. You know, I think about that. And I think about how every day I make decisions, how every day I have to live my conscience according to my faith. And it's always difficult at times because you have to balance that out and really try and become a little bit of everything for everybody. And yet we still have to stay true to our Catholic teaching. So I'm thinking of it in light of a judge. I think how traumatic that must be at times for you to have to balance those two issues in your life, being Catholic and also looking at the laws on the books that you have to enforce.
The decisions that you have to make as a judicial officer sometimes are very difficult. But when you come to the position with a lifetime of experiences, both in human interaction and in the law, it can be it's not an easy process, but it helps to have gone through it and having represented many different people and groups. And also being a person who grew up in a family where service to community, service to church, service to nation was so emphasized, and a very devout Catholic family, have a strong faith base.
Yeah.
And I think about what I do. I pray about what I do a lot. And it's a journey, but it's a journey that is able to be traveled because of the reflection I try to make and the decisions, because every one of these decisions, every single decision, even in the most simple case, is going to have many times generational impact on the individuals and the families and their children.
Exactly. I can see the ramifications can go a long way sometimes. You can't see it at the beginning.
Right.
But before we get into that, I think people need to know who James Redford is. So let's go back a few years.
Okay.
And you said you came from a Catholic background.
I do.
Born and raised Catholic?
Yes.
Both parents?
Yes. My dad converted to the church before he and my mom married after the Second World War. Dad had served in the Army and met my mom when they were both working at Chrysler in Detroit after Dad had gotten out of active duty, after he was released from active duty. And they met. My mother came from a very strong and long Catholic family and a large Catholic family. She grew up in Bay City, and my dad had been raised in Massachusetts and then throughout the country.
Okay. Do you know what religion he was previous?
Anglican is my recollection.
Okay.
So, and they, so they were active in their faith life as well. But my dad had the zeal of a convert. He was a very devoted Catholic. He was actually the president of our parish council.
Really?
In our parish, Jesu Parish in Detroit, growing up. Interestingly, I was born in Toledo, was baptized in Jesu Parish in Toledo, received all my sacraments at Jesu Parish in Detroit, and then I went to John Carroll for undergraduate school, which is a very fine Jesuit school I had the privilege of going to. And it was Jesu Parish in Cleveland was my parish. So I thought just every parish was Jesu until I went on active duty in the Navy, and then I realized, oh, there are a lot of different parishes.
That's right. So you're here going to – you went to high school, Catholic high school?
I have a Catholic education from the second grade through my law degree.
Okay.
So I went to Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, taught the grade school I attended, and we had some – truly remarkable women who dedicated themselves to the church and to the Lord and to, teaching kids, really about commitment and values and sacrifice.
Yeah.
And it was really inspirational. And then I went to Detroit Catholic Central, which was the Congregation of St. Basil.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a wonderful order of priests who I just admire so many of the priests and lay teachers that I had through those years. And then my undergraduate education is at John Carroll Jesuit School. And then my law degree is from the University of Detroit.
Okay.
Now the University of Detroit Mercy.
Yes.
But it's one of the fine 26 Jesuit universities.
Yes.
And so I have two Jesuit degrees and a diploma from the Congregation of St. Basil.
Wonderful. So, well, you know, just to kind of reinforce the Jesuits, I recently was just commissioned as a spiritual director. I went through Manresa.
Oh, wonderful.
In Detroit there in Bloomfield Hills. And I got immersed in the Jesuit spirituality.
It is. It really is. It's both the Congregation of St. Basil and the Jesuits really had a very substantial impact on who I am as a person. As my family, of course, the most, but the Basilians and the Jesuits, the lessons that I learned from the Jesuits, especially at John Carroll, over the dormitory carved in the wall before you left the dormitory door, at Dolan Hall, where I lived for 3 years at John Carroll, was to the greater glory of God. So it's ad majorem de gloriam. So it's the Jesuits trying to teach you to be a person for others.
Right.
And the teachings of St. Ignatius of Loyola and his spiritual exercises, and it gives you such a excellent base of value-based decision making.
Yes.
And you don't have to be Catholic. You just it's values of, you know, doing things for others, understanding that you have through whatever source you've received it, you have certain gifts. And as Catholics, we view them as blessings, and we view the source from one way. But you don't have to view it from that. The source is this one same thing. And looking at the analysis of St. Ignatius and the spiritual exercises, as well as the other teachings of the great saints of the church,
right?
You know, it teaches us to, you know, really give back, and that we're just temporary custodians of the gifts that
absolutely.
We've been given.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah, and so just a very, very committed family growing up. I had five older sisters and a younger brother.
Whoa.
And it was great. And you, as you know, Deacon, because you were with my family when my mom passed.
Yes.
And you were there while we prayed we had prayed the three rosaries with her in the days that she was getting ready to go be with the Lord. And then
right.
we finally said, you know, we haven't done the luminous mysteries. Let's do that. And we prayed that, and 5 minutes later, she was ready to go.
Yeah. Isn't that wonderful?
It was. It was.
Isn't that wonderful?
You know, it's, as you know, Mom started to pray the rosary daily when she started carrying me. I think she needed all the help the Lord could give her. So, and she continued throughout the whole rest of her life for the next 50 years.
Yeah.
And just a remarkable person. You were there with my sisters and
yes.
I and my brother when she passed. And it was she was a remarkable woman, as my father was a remarkable man.
You know, it's a profound time in a family when you have the honor to send someone off to the Lord in the way that your family did too. Because, you know, when you're around them, I mean, what a glorious way to pass away with the people that love you. I mean, I think of all the poor souls that lay somewhere and never have one person be with them. And yet we are so blessed in many of our times in our families to have that. So thanks be to God.
No, amen to that. And I remember that you gave the sermon at her funeral a week later, and you said, and there were the Redfords storming the gates with the rosary to
right.
bring Mom home. And it was a very moving thing, the
yeah.
whole process.
But it is.
So,
it is.
Yeah, so Dad was, you know, like I said, Dad was active in the parish. My mother was very active in the Christ Child Society in Detroit and helping families with children with special needs, and just really showed us, you know, by example, you know, what was expected of you as a layperson. And then I had an aunt who just a brilliant woman, Michigan, University of Michigan grad, pharmacist, and she felt the call. And then when she turned 40, she became a medical missionary nun.
Praise God.
And Aunt Winnie was spent almost most of the next 50 years in either India, Pakistan, or New Guinea.
Wow.
And, you know, she had come back, and she was in her late 70s, and she was doing prison ministry work for and teaching in the Pennsylvania prison system. And these were hardened
absolutely.
criminals.
Absolutely.
And Winnie was – they loved her, and she went in and taught with them and did it for several years. And she went to her mother superior and said, I really love what I'm doing. I value it, but I really want to get back in the field. And she said, Winnie, you're 78 years old. And she said, no, I can do it. I'm ready to go. Off she goes to Papua New Guinea for 6 years.
My goodness.
And just a remarkable person.
She was living her life for
she was. It was – she was an amazing person. I had a number of other aunts and uncles like that. Yeah. And very committed cousins also of deep faith and different religions. But
what a beautiful witness to you that your aunt was. Not only was she living a Christian faith, but that she immersed in her Catholic faith.
Right.
And living it out.
No, it was. It was an inspirational thing to be raised in a family like that. And it I think, led each of the seven of us as kids to some aspect of service. My brother and I did 28 years in the military. Tommy did 28 active duty, and I did 28 in the reserves. I have three sisters who are teachers, and then two other sisters that are just super active volunteers in their communities.
Wow.
So it was neat, and it's a good grounding base.
Yep.
That it helps with that grounding every day with the decisions I have to make as a judicial officer.
Sure. Well, now, Jim Redford comes out of college. In what law school again?
UD.
Yep. UD. So you come out of there as an attorney.
As a law grad. I became an attorney the first time.
Okay.
So,
are you married yet?
I am, and have been for 28 years to my wonderful wife, Diane.
Okay.
And then we've been blessed with three great children, Paige, Mary Catherine, and Spencer. And they're great kids, and they're 27, 23, and 21. And one's in law school now. One's an artist in Western New York, and Spencer's a senior in college.
Well, and I know one was a Eagle Scout.
Yes, yeah. Spencer is an Eagle Scout, and so was I.
I was privileged to be there.
You were.
Yes.
You were great. And I was an Eagle Scout, and my brother was. And the girls are also Gold Award winners, which is sort of the Girl Scouts of America equivalent to the Eagle Scout Award. So we're a big scouting family.
Before we go any farther, I want you to just explain the importance of scouting. And the Eagle, I mean, Eagle Scout is a hard one to attain. It's amazing. But, you know, it had to have an impact on you and then on your son.
It did.
Your daughters.
No, clearly. I've been a registered Boy Scout since 1971 when I joined Troop 191 in Jesu Parish. And the four boys, we were 15 and 16 years old, who received our Eagle Scout together. Three of them, two of these guys are still two of my best friends. One fellow just moved away from Michigan, and we didn't stay in touch. But it's a values-based organization which has uniformly applicable rules and standards and expectations that can help a young man grow to become a boy, to become a responsible young man.
Yeah.
And in my chambers at the at the courthouse, I have a credenza behind my desk, and I have a computer. And then to the right of my computer, I have about five books, and one of them is a book with the U.S. and Michigan constitutions and a number of other sort of charter documents of liberty. And then another one is a hymnal book because I like to sing. And then I have a Bible, and I have a Boy Scout handbook. And when I find myself in times where I need to step back and not just read and study the law and understand it better, but where I have to just think about what I'm doing and think about who I am, not what my job is as a judge, but who I am as a person, I'll pull out my Boy Scout handbook, or I'll pull out the Bible, or pull out the hymnal book, or the Constitution book, and read it for a time. And that really helps ground me back to, all right, now I need to go do my duty as a judicial officer here in the state of Michigan.
You know, and you know, what you're talking about is character. It builds character.
It does.
And, you know, they always say your character is what you're doing when nobody's watching. That's your character. And you're describing what you're doing when nobody's watching. You're really building your character continually, because that's important for you and for all of us.
It is important. And, you know, everybody – I fail every day. And the important part is when you fail to
stand back up.
No, I think I'm probably ahead of you on that one. But you stand up and you do the best you can with the abilities that you have and the talents that you've been given. So, yeah, scouting was important to us. After law school, I went on active duty in the Navy, and the lessons in the Navy were very important.
Tell me about the Navy experience, because you're also still involved in that, right?
I'm now retired.
Okay.
I retired in August 1st, 2012.
Okay.
In the beginning of my third year of law school, my younger brother, this was 1984, and Tommy had just gotten his undergraduate degree from Michigan, and he was an Air Force ROTC cadet. And our brother-in-law, John, flew up and administered the commissioning oath to Tommy at North Hall at U of M.
Wow.
And that was very moving. And then 3 months later, Tommy administered the commissioning oath to me. He commissioned me as a United States Naval officer. Mine was much less ceremonious, but it was at the recruiting station. But Tommy did it, and I was so honored that he was willing to and able to. And then so I had a year in the student JAG program and then went on active duty after the bar exam in August of 1985 and was on continuous active duty for about 5 years, just short of 5 years, and was went through the training pipeline in Newport, Rhode Island, and came home beginning of October and went back. And on my birthday in October that year, Diane gave me the best present I ever had because I proposed to her on my birthday and she said yes.
Oh, so wonderful.
It was a great thing. And I think she was surprised. And so by surprise.
How long do you know her prior to being engaged?
Just over 2 years.
Okay.
And so we'd known each other right around 3 years when we were married. And it was I went back and I was on active duty station in Virginia and then stationed over in Europe for a couple of years. Traveled all around Europe and parts of Africa, parts of the Middle East, and throughout the North Atlantic trying cases for the Navy. And then
The listeners know, and again, this is Deacon Jim Thorndale. You're listening to Holy Family Radio, and I'm with the Honorable Judge James Redford here, and we're talking about conscience and moral character and all that stuff that goes with being a judge. But we're really kind of on a journey with him right now. But I want to go back to what we were talking about just previous to that, and that was about your wife.
Mm-hmm.
And you said you'd known her 2 years prior to it.
Yes.
Okay. And then you were married what year?
1986.
Okay. So then when you talked about you trying cases for the Navy,
mm-hmm.
what would that entail? Let our listeners understand what that would mean.
Sure. It was long before the advent of all the electronic computer. We had computers, obviously, but nothing with the speed of communications that we do now. And so
still had that string above with the beads on it.
Just about, yeah. But in Norfolk, I was a defense counsel for a year and a half, and that was a land-based situation. So you had a law library, and you went and you tried things the old-fashioned way, and tried a lot of cases. So yep. It was a big base, and we had 20 defense counsel and 16 prosecutors, and it was just a bedlam. There was always things going on. So you'd find out about a case and you'd be trying it a week later. You know, it was just very exciting as a young lawyer and a young naval officer.
Now, these cases would always be based on somebody in the military.
Yes. Our clients and the individuals who were involved would always be active duty service members or reservists who had been kept on active duty for disciplinary processing reasons.
Would you be assigned or would you get to choose?
You'd be assigned. And so I was a defense counsel and I was assigned, and I had probably 60 court-martial clients and probably 100 administrative discharge board clients in an 18-month period. So we're just going crazy.
I mean,
it was exciting and you learned a lot and you made a ton of mistakes, but the kids and older sailors and Marines that you represented were generally appreciative. And if they wanted to, they could always hire their own lawyer that we would then help with.
Right.
But they were entitled under the Uniform Code of Military Justice to have appointed counsel. So I did that for 18 months and then was offered and accepted orders overseas. And so we lived in southern Spain for 2 years, and that was a wonderful experience and travel.
Yeah, your wife was with you then.
Yes, Diana. Diane was with us. And
who I'm privileged to know, too.
So yeah, you know all the
beautiful lady.
Thank you. Yes, she is a wonderful, beautiful person.
Yes.
I'm very fortunate that she puts up with me.
Yeah,
and,
amen.
But it was funny, Jim, because Paige was supposed to be born in Spain. And so we're home on – this is in 87, and we're home on transitional leave. And we went inner tubing up at our river place where you came to help inter mom's ashes.
Yes.
And so we went inner tubing. Diane's like, I don't feel that good. I'm like, oh, I'm sure you're fine. You know? And so I'm there with my mom and dad and some buddies because I'm not going to be back for a couple years probably. And Diane wakes up. She goes, I think, well, as it turned out, of course, her water broke. And Paige was 2 months premature. We thought it might be 3 months. And so through a series of events, we eventually, about 6 hours later, we're in Traverse City. And Paige is born premature in Traverse City and 5 pounds, 1 ounce.
Oh, my gosh.
It was something. Paige was great. She was fine. She didn't have to be. It was such a miracle. And that was amazing. And so – but then I had to ship out.
Yeah.
And I had to go to my brother's wedding to be the best man that next week out in Nevada, and then go to Norfolk, try my last case, flew home for 3 days, and then – I flew out of Metro, and, you know.
Did you have to wave goodbye to Diane?
Yeah. And they came over a couple months later. And
That had to be painful.
It was – I'm 26 years old, and I'm leaving my – and Paige has just regained to her birth weight at that point.
Yeah.
And the other thing that was pretty – very sobering was – my mom and dad are older, and even though, you know, as you know, my mother lived a number of years, I didn't know what was going to happen. My dad's dad did not have a long life, and I thought, gosh, what if this is it? You know, and that was very traumatic.
Yeah.
But they fortunately they lived a number of other years. Mom a lot, dad not as many. But at any rate, so that was. Yeah, that was something. And then for 2 years, I didn't come back to the United States because of military responsibilities. And it was very exciting, and you know, you would, when you tried cases over in those days, you might not know about the case until the morning. You walk into work in the morning and literally say, "Okay, the battle group is at this part of this ocean, this sea, and you're going to go to this place. You're going to fly here. Or you're going to take a train, or you're going to take a ferry, or you're going to whatever." And it was called MOJAG, Mobile Judge Advocates, and we would. You know, it was the motto of the command was anytime, anywhere. And we would literally, with no notice, you could be on the road for a month, 3 weeks. And it was very exciting for the lawyers and the legal men and the officers. But it was very hard on the families.
Oh, of course.
Because they're, okay, what are we going to have for dinner? And then the next thing you know, I'll bring home something from the commissary. And the next thing you know, your spouse has seen you an hour and a half later. Hey, what's going on? I got to pack my bag. I'm going for 3 weeks. And it's sort of like, you're kidding. It's like, not at all. My sister Martha, who you've met as well, her husband was an Air Force officer at the time. And they lived in Germany. And we'd go back and forth to see him twice. And they came to see us once. But they came down first time to visit. Any family member would come to visit. And the battle group needed a legal team. On Thanksgiving Day, you know, okay, I'm going out tomorrow, you know, instead. And they're like, okay. And I mean, my brother-in-law is a retired Air Force girl. He's like, okay, no problem.
Let me ask you this question, Jim, because it's bringing up a thought in my head. If it wasn't for your faith-based relationship with your wife and with your God, how do you think your marriage would have sustained? How do other marriages sustain when you see all that going on? I mean, some of them must have been really pressured with men being gone all the time and women being left alone.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to how other families handled it.
I thought maybe you witnessed some of it.
Yeah, I did, but I don't think it's necessarily appropriate to comment on it.
Yeah, no, I think
that the fact that Diane and I share – Diane's a very devout Presbyterian and a member of a wonderful Presbyterian church that we go to here in Grand Rapids and have for years. And the kids have been formed in both the Presbyterian and Catholic churches. But without that, you know, Christian-based, you know, three-part relationship of marriage, you know, it's not just she and I. It's, you know, I do promise and covenant before God and these witnesses that I will be thy loving and faithful husband in plenty and in want and sickness and in health. And so, you know, we have that sacramental-based relationship that sustains us. And not just when we were young kids over doing crazy, you know, trying to, you know, get by in Europe, but every day.
You're right. You know? I think the point I was trying to make is that how stressful – and I wasn't speaking of it in particular.
Okay.
Just how stressful that can be if you didn't have that solid faith-based sacramental relationship till death do us part, because it would be very hard. I mean, I used to travel for a living – Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and I'd be gone 3 weeks. And right. It's always tough.
It is hard. And I have many friends who, unfortunately, their marriages didn't last.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, after I left active duty, I stayed in the reserves for 23 years. And you're gone a lot then, too, not with quite as much regularity, but it's a it adds your spouse has to be such a strong partner and such a strong person. Diane's a far stronger person than I am in so many ways, and she's maintained the heavy load, you know, with especially when the kids were younger, but even throughout high school and college, it's hard. And she really has sacrificed a tremendous amount for us to be able to allow me to do these things that, you know, I feel called to do.
Yeah. And you know, being the wife she is, the woman that she is, I know that she was honoring you and the Lord in allowing that to happen, too. That,
no, and it's a wonderful it's thing. It's a humbling thing to have somebody that's that committed.
So as you're in the Navy, is your career growing in the Navy?
It is. I eventually I had increasing positions of responsibility on active duty. And then when I left active duty, I really didn't intend to – I became a federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office here in the Western District of Michigan when I left active duty, and I really didn't intend to stay in the reserves. I thought, okay, I did my 5 years. That's good. And then 2 days after I left active duty, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and this was in August of 1990, and I had just left active duty August 1st. And it was either August 2nd or August 3rd, and I thought, oh, my gosh, this – I've just been over in that area of the world, and for a long time, for 2 years, and I hadn't been to the Middle East a lot, but I'd been there. And so I contacted some friends in D.C., and I said, I'd really like to volunteer to go over to the Middle East. And they said, okay, well, what reserve unit are you in? I said, well, I'm not in one. They said, you got to be in a unit, otherwise I can't mobilize you. I said, okay. So I ended up affiliating with a reserve unit and ended up not getting mobilized to the Middle East. And you know, but continue to begin a relationship with the reserves.
What was your intention of going over there?
To go serve in our, my country was at war. I wanted to serve. And, there was not an opportunity for someone in my pay grade and my level of experience to go forward deployed. I could have been mobilized to sort of backfill. But at the time, I was already starting to prosecute sort of large-scale drug cases and money laundering cases. And I think I'm going to stay here. And I said, I'll go if you need me. But no, we don't. We got plenty of volunteers. But if you really want to go, I can get you someplace. But not, I can't get you to the Middle East.
Okay.
Said, okay. Then I'm probably not going to volunteer. And he said, okay, that's fine. But because of that, I began an affiliation with the reserves, which – after about a year and a half in the reserves, I wasn't sure I wanted to keep doing it. And then I had an opportunity to serve aboard a couple of different shipboard units out of San Diego. And I always loved being at sea. I was never ship's company, but I was at sea a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's such a privilege, Jim, to serve with these young women and men of our country. Yeah, they have such commitment. And so much patriotism and so much selfless service. It is truly inspirational to be around them. And so I had this chance to serve in these seagoing units. So I took those, and then that kept me involved for a few more years. I kept getting promoted. And
just so, again, so our listeners understand, what capacity would you be doing on the ship then?
I was the executive officer of a reserve unit of about 45 sailors. So I would be the number two leadership guy in the organization.
Okay.
And then so I'd be responsible for sort of management and oversight of the day-to-day requirements and needs of my sailors and that I had the privilege of serving with. And then when I would go to the ship, I would be the staff judge advocate, where I would provide legal counsel and advice to the unit, to the COs, and I would do a lot of what's called legal assistance, especially pre-deployment things, where I would meet with young sailors and Marines before they would go on deployment to make sure their wills are ready, make sure their trusts and estates are ready, make sure powers of attorneys are ready, and to help the kids to be – mobilization ready so that they can focus on what their job is on deck plate as opposed to worrying and a lot of the kids are single parents.
Yeah. House in order.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that I would do a lot of that. I would also help in Otherwise, with at the base legal office, if things got slow at the waterfront, and the ships that I happened to be on would be there were a few, not that many ships. I was on two or three, and if they were in port and there wasn't a lot going on, I'd go over to the legal service office and help and volunteer and do some training because I was at that point I'm starting to be a fairly experienced litigator. So that was an interesting assignment for a few years, and then I was. Then I did appellate litigation in Washington, D.C. for appeals of court martials, where I was a lawyer writing briefs. And I didn't actually ever orally argue, but wrote a lot of briefs and helped out on that. And then eventually was promoted.
If you're right, who would do the oral arguments? Would somebody else?
The active duty guys.
Okay.
Yeah. But one of my colleagues who had a little more free time than I did, he was a reservist, he also did the arguments. But I just didn't have enough time to stay for the oral arguments.
Yeah.
And I was doing a lot of oral arguments at that point in the Sixth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, so I didn't feel like, I didn't need to do it for professional development.
Exactly.
So that was interesting, and then transitioned into some other jobs. One was being the staff judge advocate for Naval Air Station Sigonella, Sicily, and that was a lovely assignment.
Really?
It was exciting, and it's a very busy base in the – nickname of the base is the crossroads of the Med, and so anything going in and out of the Mediterranean for the U.S. Navy and a lot of Air Forces going through there. And so that was fun, and I had that just for a little less than a year, but it was good. I got over there.
Now, would Diane be with you with the kids?
Diane came over, not with the kids.
Okay.
She came over that trip. That was fun. That was a good trip. She came over for about a week, and we got to go, Jim, and there's this in Sicily. Gosh, I just love Sicily.
Yeah.
But there's there's this area called the Valley of the Temples, and it's down on the southern coast, and it's St. Paul and St. Peter went through there. And so we're walking along these paths that
– These apostles walked.
The apostles.
Yeah.
The apostle Paul landed in a town – that we went and walked all around. And you're literally walking in the footsteps of the apostles.
Yeah.
And, these ancient Greek temples that have been converted to Christendom, just really – it gives you such a vivid picture of what the biblical time
and,
was.
And what those men went through.
Oh, my gosh.
When you look at that.
Well, and to think – I've traveled on large U.S. Navy warships in that area, and it's not fast to get from one point to the other in those things. They're going around in Phoenician galleys, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
So, the Lord moved them around in remarkable ways.
It
really is.
It's a beautiful – I think I told you I was privileged to be over in Rome for the canonization of the popes. We were in a lot of the different areas that you're describing. It's just phenomenal journey when you stop and think the people that have gone before us and the sacrifices they made that the church would survive.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And you talk about the Pope as I wear the scapular that my mother brought back after a trip in 1980 that St. John Paul the Great blessed. And I lost it this summer. And I was so disappointed. For several months I didn't have the scapula that was blessed by the St. John Paul, and I was really and I told Diane how upset I was, and and just the other day we're doing something and she walked up and she goes, "Are you looking for something?" I'm like, "Oh my gosh." She goes, "Jim, this is your mother telling you to be nicer to me," because we had a bit of an argument. I thought, you're absolutely right, honey. So I got it back. But when you talk about the blessing of the popes or the canonization of the popes, you think of – we have such examples in Christian history of remarkable individuals, of people who were persons for others.
Yeah.
From the apostles to St. John Paul. And you think of what St. John Paul did as far as the seminarian in Nazi-occupied Germany.
Right. And underground seminary.
Underground, exactly. It's just
– Yeah.
And, this voice of compassion, of respect, of dignity – you know, it's and then what happened during the term of his candidacy, you know, his papacy. Well, let's see. The Soviet Union's gone.
The wall.
You know, what else happened? You know, it's a remarkable thing. So.
And there was a great relationship between him and President Reagan.
Oh, my gosh, it was.
They really hit it off. But you think about that. I think of Karl Wojtyla, who was this young man going to an underground seminary. Never does he imagine the man that he's going to be asked to be.
Right.
And but again, his character put him into that role, and he served us beautifully in our church.
It's a remarkable thing to be able to live during that papacy.
Yeah.
You know, it's really been something.
So let's talk a little bit more about James Redford now, then, because here you're in the Navy.
I am.
Now, here you are now in the you're a judge here in Grand Rapids. But tell us about that journey. How did that come about? Because not all attorneys there are judges.
No, and some never choose to be. And
right.
And I was I had stayed in the Navy, and I continued in 2002. Our legislature created two new seats for our local court because the population of our community had increased, and the requirements of the people and of the organizations and businesses in the circuit in the Kent County area needed more. And so they do studies about every 2 to 5 years of judicial resources reports, or what they're called, JRRs. It happens to be my initials as well. But they're
called. Look at that.
So whenever I say an email that says JRR, I was like, well, what do they want me? And it's like, you know, so because I see them a lot now, because I'm the chief judge pro tem of the court, I see them a little more. But at any rate, Diane and I, we thought about it. We talked to the kids about it back in 02, and we prayed about it. And a lot of people were encouraging me to run. I'd been a lawyer for about 17 years, but we'd only lived in the county.
Were you in private practice?
I was in private practice. I'd left the U.S. Attorney's Office. I was a partner in a wonderful law firm. Everything is great. The firm I was with is one of the oldest and largest in Michigan, and everything was really going well. In every way. And, but we, you know, I said, you know, I really feel called to this, and, you know, I don't know if I'll win, but I think I'd really like to try. And Diane had a couple of questions, and some were financial and some were, you know, sort of spiritual. And, she said, okay, I'm with you, you know, and so we said, okay. And so a number of friends began to help us and gather the signatures necessary to get on the ballot. And, was on the ballot.
Do you recall how many signatures it took at the time?
You had to have a minimum of 2,000, and everybody who does it tries to get – and you could turn in as many as 4,000. We turned in like 2,850 or something.
Wow.
The petitions are still, I think, downstairs in the basement because once the Secretary of State is done with them, they give them back. So, you know, anyway, ours are somewhere in the basement of the Redford House. So we ran, and it was a contested primary, and there were about – at the 9 or 10 candidates seeking two seats. And so four would pass out of the primary. I was one of the four to pass out of the primary. And then in the general election, I happened to be one of the top two vote getters and had the privilege of being elected. And I've served on our bench in Kent County in the criminal and civil division for the last almost 12 years.
Wow.
And so it's been a...
How difficult is it, or I should say, what's the journey from going to, as an attorney, working in a practice, and all of a sudden you're Honorable Judge James Redford, and the responsibilities are different. The whole understanding is different now of what you're doing, because now you're overseeing.
Yes, it's very different. And I'm up until that point, for most of the 17 years I've been a lawyer, I'd been a trial litigator, either a defense counsel or a prosecutor or a civil plaintiff's lawyer or a civil defense lawyer. And I had represented some corporations and stuff. So I had a pretty wide background. And so I felt comfortable. And I had a lot of judicial role models who I really admired. And so I knew who I wanted to pattern myself after, but I didn't know if I could do it. And I still don't know. You know, somebody will tell me at the end of the – when I get to the other side, St. Peter will let me know. You did okay or not so good. I hope I'm doing okay. I'm doing the best I can.
Well, there's no such thing as judge school, is there?
There's a – we call it baby judge's school.
Okay.
You go to a school the first week – usually after everybody gets sworn in January 1st, and then the next week there's a class conducted by the Michigan Judicial Institute, which is part of the State Court Administrative Office, where it, you get sort of water from a fire hydrant as far as here's what you're doing, and you get manuals, and they assign you a mentor outside of your own court, so somebody you can go talk to who you don't have to necessarily see every day. So it's very well organized. They do a nice job. But it is, certainly when you get there and you walk in the first time and they say, all rise, you sort of look around like, who are you standing up for, So you do feel funny. I feel funny every time. Almost every day. It would be not true to say every day, but almost every day when I pull into the parking lot of our court, I say a quiet prayer as the door's going up. So, Lord, give me what I need to fulfill these duties.
But when you talk about that standing up too, it's really the protocol of our government and the way we run our system that we give the honor due the position.
It's due the office. It's not due the individual. I tell people that all the time. I said, the office I have the privilege of serving in is an important office. I'm not an important person. I'm just a regular guy just trying to do my job.
That makes sense.
But I agree completely.
Do you recall the first case you had to listen to, and were you in some type of flux, or was there some type of nervousness that you had to read?
I'm sure the first hearing, I can't tell you exactly what it was. We have a sort of set pattern in a trial court that I serve in of this is what happens on Mondays, this is what happens on Tuesdays. So I know I was beginning trials and taking plea hearings and doing sentencing. And the interesting thing was because I took over a docket, even though I was elected to a new judgeship, I assumed the docket of a judge who was retiring to serve because of how the chief judge assigned it. Mm-hmm. And so I had the responsibility immediately to begin sentencing individuals whom I have never seen and didn't take the plea of and didn't preside over the trials. And that was a challenge at first time.
I want to ask that because it's like discipline. Sometimes disciplining your children is difficult, but you have to do it. I'm thinking in terms now as a Catholic man. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to come before you, and you're going to have to discipline. You're going to have to give them some type of sentencing. That must weigh heavily on you.
It does. I think people ask me, how do I like my job? I say, I love my job. I said, Mondays are hard. And the reason Mondays are hard is that's the day I sentence. And because every case is very difficult. And as I said, it's a generational impact in many cases. And many individuals who have been convicted following a trial or been convicted through a negotiated plea resolution, nobody starts out in life saying, I want to do bad things.
Of course.
So every place and everywhere, there's some mother or dad that really hoped so much. And when they held that child as a newborn child, they never thought, I want him to be in front of some person who's deciding his liberty interest.
That's right.
So it's very difficult. One of the things I did, Jim, before I sentenced anybody, when you get elected, there's a transitional period. And, you're not working yet for the court, but, people are beginning to make things work so that things will be in a good place. So I called the local head of the probation department, who also is part of the Michigan Department of Corrections, and introduced myself by phone. We hadn't met before. And she said, Judge, nice to, I'm not judge yet, but, thank you, thanks. What can I do for you? And I said, I would like to have a tour of a maximum facility prison and a minimum security and a medium security prison. And there was this pause on the end of the line. She goes, well, why do you want to do that? I said, because I don't know if I've gotten this call before. I said, and she goes, when do you want to do it? I said, I want to do it between January 2nd and January 5th or whatever it was, because my class was going to be the following week. Mm-hmm. And so I was going to be on the payroll. I didn't feel like I should do it until I was in office. And she goes, well, why do you want to do that? I said, people may have to spend their entire lives there on an order that I'm going to send. I have a moral obligation to see what it's going to be like. I don't plan to stay there, but I want to see what it is.
Yeah.
And so there's more silence. And she goes, okay, I'll make the arrangements. And a week later, I had a tour of what's called a level six. They don't even have them anymore.
Right.
Level six facility, a level three, and a level one. And it was very sobering. And I'm very glad I did it. And it doesn't change how I'm going to sentence somebody. But I need to have an awareness of what it is that the decision I'm about to make is
exactly.
Going to do.
So I think you gave her no room for an argument because you gave her a very specific understanding that I have an obligation.
And she was great about it. And it was so important. And I'll never forget that day, you know, in those hours. But,
you know, Jim, I've had the opportunity and the privilege again of, as the prison jail minister, I've been in Ionia's maximum security.
Yep.
And it is sobering. It is one of the most sobering things that you can do, whether in ministry as I am ordained or just as a layperson, to
Absolutely.
Go in there to understand that you are incarcerated perhaps for the rest of your life.
Right.
And you live this rigid life that there's no flexibility.
Right.
And I can understand the depths of your concern about sentencing people.
Yeah. So it is the sentencing is, I find it the most difficult part of what I do by far. I think it's probably the most important thing I do. Okay. Everything – I know every case is important to every litigant that's before me.
Of course.
And to the people and to the witnesses and to the victims. But the decision of what to sentence, it's – and a lot of times the range that we – our discretionary range is extremely broad. And you just try to make the best decision and you think about it and you reflect on it.
Yep.
You know, you don't – and you pray about not what should I sentence. That's not it. You never do that. That's not – it's just give me the strength to do my duty.
Exactly.
You know, just I need
exactly.
the strength to do my duty.
Exactly.
And
but, you know,
and do it humbly.
Yeah.
And, you know.
But it's such a beautiful testimony to our legal system, you as a judge – saying that you pray. That's an understanding of knowing that there's a greater glory and a greater being than ourselves, and we rely on that for wisdom and understanding.
Just this past Tuesday, I had the privilege of attending the Red Mass in Detroit.
Yes.
And it was at St. Peter and Paul's Church.
Explain that to our listeners.
The Red Mass is offered in 100-plus dioceses every year, and it's where the Catholic Church hosts a Mass for people of all faiths, and it's usually – conducted by a bishop or a cardinal, and this was one of the auxiliary bishops of Detroit. And St. Peter and Paul is literally connected to University of Detroit Law, and it's a Jesuit parish. The last time that I was in the building was the day Paige was baptized before I shipped out.
Oh my.
So it was – and I went to the church all the time when I was a student there, but I just hadn't had a chance to go back for service. But it's where all lawyers and judges are invited. – And the Mass is it's called the Red Mass in recognition of the Holy Spirit.
Right.
And we ask the Holy Spirit at the beginning of the term of court, which is usually October or the fall, to help us do our jobs as lawyers and as judges in a way that is respectful, that's understanding. The opening song was This at the Mass was, you know, come live in the Lord, you know, and do justice, show justice, show loving, show yourself as a light.
Come live in the light.
Come live in the light.
Yeah.
And that has, to me anyway, is it translates whether you're a Christian person, whether you're not a Christian, whether you're a human, that, you know, we do seek justice.
Absolutely.
As a people, regardless of whether you're agnostic or whether you're a person of faith, we do seek to lift up those those who we have the chance to.
Yeah.
We do seek to be part of a solution. And so at this was the beginning song for the Mass, and the bishop spoke about it quite a bit in his homily and the appropriateness of it. And at this Mass, I mean, four sitting justices of the Michigan Supreme Court were there. Another 20 25, 30 other judges, the deans of the schools, the, you know, professors, and probably, you know, 100, 200 lawyers.
You know, this type of conversation has to give hope to our listeners because they understand now that the law isn't just based on what's outside of the church, or it's based on a moral creed that you follow, too, and a real sense of conscience that you have. And so you men are going before the Lord and beseeching him to bless you.
Oh, and women.
And women. So, I'm sorry. Yes, and of course, and women. But really to bless your ministry as attorneys.
Right. Right. And that's it. And whether it's, you know, I've prosecuted big cases. I've defended individuals. I've sat on panels where the Justice Department was trying to make a determination whether we're going to seek the death penalty. And I've represented somebody on death row.
Oh, my.
You know, it's just in every aspect of being a lawyer, just like in every aspect of being a dad or a spouse or a part of a community.
Yeah.
It's more important than just us. We're part of a whole community,
yeah.
a community of our fellow citizens in the church, a community of our fellow believers, and we walk together.
Exactly. Excuse me. So Jim Redford and Diane's life is going on.
It is going on.
It continues on. Let me ask you this. As you know, we all grow. We continue to grow. Any future plans for Jim Redford?
Well, not plans, but we have been involved in a little bit of stuff the last 300 days or so.
Okay.
I was asked in December by some folks that I have a lot of respect for in Lansing and throughout the state to run for the Michigan Supreme Court.
And really? So, wonderful.
Yeah. It's an exciting time. It's been a real privilege to travel throughout our state. There's a justice who was actually the Red Mass was essentially dedicated to him, and he spoke at it and he administered the oath. His name is Michael Kavanaugh, and he's a superb individual. Mm-hmm. He's been a judge for 42 years, and he's actually been on our Supreme Court for 32 years.
Oh, my. I recognize the name.
Yeah, he's a super guy and just a wonderful judge. Because of our state constitution, he cannot run again. So I was asked if I was
– Is it a term limit?
It's not a term, it's age.
Age. Okay, I thought.
In Michigan, you can neither run nor be appointed to a judicial position – after you're age 70. So Justice Kavanaugh either is now or is going to be 70 before January 1st. I don't know what his
– Probably still extremely capable.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. He could do another 15 years. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
And certainly if he were running, I would not be seeking to run against him because I have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah.
But there's an opening. And so people approach me and Diane and I talked about it. The kids and us talked about it. We prayed about it. And – said, okay, we're going to try this. And so I've been running since beginning the process since December. I officially filed in February, and I've been in 65 of Michigan's 83 counties.
Wonderful.
And I've met so many amazing people.
I'm sure.
It's just been neat. I mean, they're just – whether it's a mom who's worried about, you know, what's going on in her life, what's mm-hmm. going on in her community. And,
yeah.
and I mean, I can't solve it, but just to have the privilege of having people listen or want you to listen. So it's been amazing. And I've been to, you know, a couple hundred events, probably 150 events. And the way that I was nominated to run, so I'm on the ticket in, I'll be on the ballot in November.
Okay.
But I've offered myself up for service. And if that's what's supposed to happen, I will be privileged to try to fulfill those important constitutional responsibilities.
Wonderful.
In the footsteps of a very capable guy, Justice Kavanaugh. And if it's not what's supposed to be, I have the privilege of – I have 2 years remaining on the term. I was elected to by our fellow citizens here in Kent County, and it'll be a great honor to continue to serve there at least, you know, till the end of this term. And if they choose to let me keep going, if I run again, then then that way. So
what? Coming from where you're at now, Judge, and then going into Supreme Court, what would be primarily what you'd be doing then?
Right. I serve in the Circuit Court,
okay.
which is the trial court of general jurisdiction. So I oversee a docket of about 800 cases a year probably two-thirds criminal and felony matters and one-third civil matters. So I'm a trial judge. So I'm making decisions at the trial court level. But I'm also a one-judge court of appeals for review of decisions of our district courts or of state administrative tribunals. Above the circuit court in Michigan is the Michigan Court of Appeals. So that's called the Intermediate Court of Appeals. Those cases, those judges, unless it's an en banc where all the judges or a special panel of judges decided, usually three judges decide whether to uphold or reverse the trial court. And, you know, I've had cases that have gone up and I've been upheld. And I've had cases – I've been a trial judge for 12 years. You make 8,000, 14,000 decisions.
Yeah.
Something's going to get reversed.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I do not have – you know, I – at any rate. So you make decisions and so they go up. And then from the Court of Appeals is the state Supreme Court. And it's a seven-judge court. And the judges of that court, they are asked to review – approximately 2,000 to 3,000 cases per year. They agree to review.
And who decides on which cases go to the Supreme Court?
The parties have an automatic right of appeal to the Intermediate Court of Appeals. It's an appeal by leave to the Supreme Court.
Okay.
So if you are dissatisfied and you're a litigant in the Court of Appeals, you can petition to the Supreme Court, say, I would like my case reviewed. And so between 2,000 and 3,000 times a year, they get those petitions. And then the Supreme Court has to decide, at least four of the members of the court have to say, yes, we think we should review this. And they agree to review between 100 and 200 cases a year. It just depends on the year.
Okay.
And then the case is briefed by both sides. Sometimes what are called amicus curiae, which it means it translates to friend of the court. Briefs can be filed by interested parties either in behalf of one side or behalf of another, because once the state Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court takes a case, it has pretty far-reaching application and effect. So there are oftentimes will be separate parties will want to also be heard in the case. They don't have to hear them, but a lot of times they will. And then the Supreme Court will have oral argument, and then they meet in – conference to talk about the case,
right.
And then they'll issue an opinion. And it can either be 7-0, we uphold, we reverse. It could be 6-1, right. Or any numerical combination thereof.
Right. But
they're the ultimate determination of what the law is in Michigan. They tell us what the statutes are, whether they're constitutional or not, and they advise about the constitutionality in applying the Michigan Constitution, but also oftentimes they have to apply the U.S. Constitution. Yeah. So
those seven Supreme Court justices would get about 2,000 cases a year. They'd all read every one of those briefs? You need a four count to.
Yeah, you don't have a full briefing until they grant review. Okay. You'll have petitions for it typically. And they have a lot of very, very capable assistants who will give law clerks and you know, I can't speak to what any other judge does. I think it would be enormously challenging to read individually all 2,000.
Right.
I suspect some do, and I would certainly try to do as much as I could.
It was kind of taxing in my mind when you said that. I mean, wow, that would be a tremendous amount.
It's a super – and I know every member of the court who's there now, they're all really capable people, very hardworking, very committed. So we're very lucky in Michigan for the folks that we've got there.
Well, Jim, I just I know we're running out of time here. I just want to thank you for this time, because it's opened my eyes to our legal system too. Just hearing this journey that you're on and having a clearer understanding of what it means to be a man or a woman, a Catholic man or woman, living in this law system that really is something that you've been formed so beautifully as a Catholic, but you also have an obligation to the Constitution that you live under.
Absolutely.
And so you live in these worlds, and you have to bring them together. And so now you're really stepping up to the plate and looking perhaps, if the electors deem it necessary, that you be Supreme Court Justice here in Michigan.
Well, I'd be enormously humbled if that's what they decided, and we'll find out on November 5th.
Well, thanks be to God that you've articulated so beautifully. Number one, your Catholic faith. And number two, your love of your family and the love of your country, because it really is the testimony to who you are as a man, being this Eagle Scout that you were, and really just letting that flourish in your life, because, as you said, it was instrumental in your building your character. And so I know you've been a friend of mine, and, yeah. And I appreciate that. And
you're very kind, Jim. Thank you.
Well, you're so welcome. And we'll be praying for you on this journey, because it's really going to be God's will be done. His providence will lead you on that.
As in all things.
Yeah, so I wish you the best with you and your family, Jim.
Okay.
It's always a privilege to know you. And thank you for being here, and I thank all the people on our listening audience, Holy Family Radio, for listening.
Thank your listeners for joining us today. It was really nice.
Thank you as much, Jim. God bless.
You too.
Good having you here.
Thanks. Thank you, Jim.
Been listening to Living the Catholic Life with your host Deacon Jim Thorndale on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Thank you for listening.